This is Silver Star Bible School, the year 2001. Our overall theme for the school is faith, hope, and love. This is session number 3, class number 6. Our speaker is Brother Ken Stiles. His subtitle, "The Love of Many Shall Wax Cold." The reading for this class came from Deuteronomy chapter 15.
We'd like to begin, brethren and sisters, by expressing our sincere gratitude to each of you and to what's happened this week and the spiritual benefits that we have received from being here. It's marvelous how when we create and all the effort that goes in to this short 7-day period of time, but when a spiritual environment is created like we've seen this week, God can work marvelous things in our lives. The prayers we've had this week and our own thoughts as we reflect and ruminate upon His Word and the principles that have been developed in the classes and in conversation, it's all part of God trying to reach us in these last days, to take this week, this special time that is devoted entirely to Him and in which we separate ourselves from the influences of the world. Those thoughts we've had this week, those commitments we've made, that internal reflection, that's all part of the week, and it's a necessary part, and it's important that we take it with us. God has shown us this week, and the Bible school has shown us this week how to live our lives as disciples. It takes study from His Word, but it also takes meals of fellowship in which we're discussing with one another the good things that we enjoy. It involves singing together and sharing the glory and praise of our Father, whether it's on Thursday night at the final presentation or if it's in the practices or if it breaks out in singing up at the top of the mountain at 6:15 in the morning. It takes an investment in our young people. There was a tremendous investment this week from the youngest to the oldest of the young people. And we need that kind of investment made back home. This is what living the truth is all about. And the young people and the children enjoyed themselves. They can enjoy themselves in the truth. The truth doesn't have to be a burden. This week wasn't accidental. It was taking all of the aspects of the truth and compressing them into 7 short days to show us that it can be done. There's no reason we can't take this spirit and these various activities that we've been involved in with us, because God can continue to work great things in our life. A couple of negative examples to begin this class. We've looked at several positive in the Old Testament. We won't spend too much time on them, would commend them to your own study later on, but parents, godly love is so vital in raising our kids. Human love is so easy to use. Eli stands out as an excellent example of a brother who held a very high position in the ecclesia, couldn't go much higher than high priest, and yet he failed to hold his sons accountable to living the truth. He favored their love and chose to honor them over Yahweh. And it shows us the danger as parents that we can get into, that when we stop requiring our children to obey God's commands in our house, we stop practicing godly love. It's as simple as that. So that when our children grow up and all we have been doing is practicing human love and we've been bending the rules and foregoing the standards and turning a blind eye to iniquity so that they will continue to enjoy the truth on a compromised basis, when they grow up having been raised on human love, when they find out that God deals with us on godly love, they probably won't accept it or embrace it. It's critical that godly love be the love that we use. Not that we have to make life miserable for them. They can enjoy themselves in the truth. Those young kids last night and their plays and their singing, they were having a good time. It is possible. But a good time within the context of godly principles. Jehoshaphat, and we understand you've looked at his example and his alliance with Ahab already. But there it is in chapter 19 when the prophet makes his assessment. Yes, Jehoshaphat, you showed love. You showed human love, not godly love, because you weren't leading Ahab to righteousness. You were doing Ahab all kinds of favors, but you weren't leading him to righteousness. Godly love under every single circumstance will lead a person towards righteousness. And if our love for one another, or if what we think is love to one another, is not leading a person to righteousness, it is not godly love. The second epistle of John shows that Jehoshaphat's misunderstanding of love was not confined to the Old Testament. The ecclesia to whom John is writing is confused about what love is and what love isn't. They had a wrong understanding of godly love, and it was having disastrous results. In the name of love, they were welcoming false brethren into their midst and thinking that is what God wanted them to do. And we know from 1 John that those who were bringing the doctrine of the Antichrist were undermining the moral heart of the doctrine of the atonement, that we ought to lay down our life for one another. And it shows us in 2 John how easy it is for us to become deceived by love. And you can imagine the arguments at their business meetings. Some would say we shouldn't extend love, we shouldn't extend fellowship to these brethren. Others would say, how can that possibly be the love of Christ? We should extend love to all. And as a result, they were being guided by that wrong understanding. They end up with a distorted picture. It's amazing that they're misguided. Or distorted picture, their misguided understanding of love and extending fellowship, welcoming false brethren who taught there was no need to lay down your life for your brother, tracing it back to 1 John, because Christ didn't really come in the flesh. The result was that neither the ecclesia nor the false brethren that would visit them had a proper understanding of godly love. And as a result, the ecclesia was willing to accommodate error, all under the banner of love. And like Jehoshaphat, they were extending love, but it wasn't godly love, it was human love. In verse 5 and 6 of 2 John, he has to go back to the beginning. Let me remind you, he says, of what the definition of godly love is. And now I beg you, lady, not as though I were writing you a new commandment, but the one we have had from the beginning, that we love one another. And this is love. This is godly love, that we follow his commandments. This is the commandment, as you have heard from the beginning, that you follow love. Get your understanding of godly love right, and then you will get your fellowship practice right. And you can see where distorted understanding of godly love takes us. Because not only did the ecclesia have the wrong understanding, but they then, in the name of love, extend fellowship to those who had a misunderstanding of love. And it's no coincidence that the two of those groups were able to meet together, because neither one understood what godly love was, but for different reasons. One based on a false doctrine, the other based on a false doctrine or a false understanding of what godly love was. And in verse 8, here's the danger. Look to yourselves, he says, that you may not lose what you have worked for, but may win a full reward. You see, that's what's at risk. If we lose our understanding of what godly love is, and we misapply it in the name of human love, thinking that it's godly love, it's such a serious offense that we can lose and jeopardize our reward, all that we've worked for. On a positive note, turn over to Philippians 1. Amazing how when some of these principles come together and when godly love is at work in an ecclesia and in the lives of brethren and sisters, it's amazing what God can do in that environment.
Because in Philippians 1, we have a description of the body responding to the trial of a member, and they responded in love. And we'll see from this that godly love covers all aspects of discipleship. We haven't spent much time this week talking about witnessing, but we're going to see in this example that godly love includes giving to the need of those who have a need. And those around us have a need of coming to an understanding of the truth, at least being warned of the days that we're living in and what's coming upon the earth. Godly love says that we would stand up and share with them what we understand. But the setting in Philippians 1 and the area that he is writing to is that this is likely the time period in which he's been imprisoned in Rome for 2 whole years, as he says at the end of Acts. And the result of his being imprisoned is that his preaching efforts have been extremely curtailed. About the only ones he could preach to were the Praetorian Guard. Now, he pretty well got to every one of them, as he says, but that was the extent to which he could preach. And this is a man who has devoted his life to the preaching of the word and the defense of the gospel. And now he sits in prison for 2 years. Do you know how many converts he could have made if the Lord would have released him and allowed him 2 more years in Mesopotamia, 2 more years among those ecclesians? And yet, in the Lord's wisdom, he kept Paul in prison for 2 years. In addition to him being in prison, there were insincere brethren who were taking advantage of Paul's imprisonment. And they were out preaching now, out of envy and strife, only to add, he says in verse 17, to his affliction, to his suffering. But there were others. There were others who were sincere brethren and sisters who saw Paul's affliction and responded to his affliction in godly love and preached, he said, out of goodwill. We'll pick up the account in verse 12. I want you to know, brethren, this is Philippians 1, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel, so that it has become known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard and in all other places that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brethren have been made confident or emboldened in the Lord because of my imprisonment, and are much more bold to speak the word of God without fear. Some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. So the response to the ecclesia, many had gone out and were now preaching in the name of Christ because of what they had seen take place in Paul's life. So even though Paul couldn't get out and preach, and he couldn't get out and defend the gospel that he says was his objective in verse 16, what do you do if you're a brother or sister in Philippi and you learn that Paul is imprisoned in Rome and it's apparent that he's not going to get out? What does godly love look like in this situation? You stand up, and in love, you go out and do the work that Brother Paul isn't able to. And that's what they did. Marvelous how the ecclesia responded. They went out and continued his work, the work that he couldn't do. And they waxed confident, as he said, by his bonds to speak the word more boldly. They understood, the Philippian brethren and sisters did, that the trial that Paul was experiencing was from God. Paul didn't want to be in prison. He would have loved to have been free. But God had put him in prison under trial, and that Paul's suffering under trial and his restricted preaching ability now made it necessary for the rest of the ecclesia to stand up and carry on the work of Paul, so that the word could be preached more widely than had Paul remained free. And that is exactly what happened. Now, instead of just one brother going out and preaching, because it's so easy when we have an apostle Paul in our midst to let him do all the preaching, because he's so good at it. In fact, you just kind of like to listen to him preach, because he's so good. And as long as he's here next week, he can do it again and do it again. But when he's now taken out of our midst, now the rest of us have to stand up and carry on the work. And there were greater works that were shown through the Philippians because they responded to that situation. So see, you see the impact and the wisdom of God's hand at work. Just to continue the text, in verse 17, the former, these are the ones that were preaching to intensify Paul's anguish, the former proclaimed Christ out of partisanship, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. And in verse 16, we should have read, the latter do it out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. They knew Paul was put on the earth, so to speak, to defend the gospel and to preach, and because he couldn't, we will take up the slack. And they are now carrying on his work that he cared so deeply for. This is how godly love responds to a brother or sister under trial. And imagine the impact this would have had on Paul in prison in Rome. In the midst of this trial, he can think of a dozen reasons why, if the Lord will let him get out, good things can happen. Just let me out. Good things will happen. Doesn't get out. And then word starts to trickle in. Paul, you know what's happening as a result of your trial and your confinement? All these brethren and sisters who formerly were not preaching, they are now out preaching the gospel because of their love for you and their love for Christ. And brethren and sisters, this is how we respond to a brother or sister who is under trial. We need not sit back and wish there was something we could do to help them. Godly love says if a brother or sister comes under trial, we step forward and continue on their work. We change our way of life. Paul hears there are brethren and sisters preaching now that have never preached before. So if a brother or sister comes under trial, we step forward and carry on their work in the ecclesia. Or we carry on their work in raising their children, whatever it is. So that in the midst of their trial and suffering, when they hear that we have changed our life, we weren't preaching, now we are. We weren't spending any time with their children, and now we're spending every time that we have available with them, whatever the work may be. When they hear in the midst of their trial that we have changed their life, changed our life, and we've changed our life and it's drawing us closer to righteousness, that will bring great joy, great encouragement to that brother or sister in trial. Paul could genuinely and sincerely rejoice knowing that his trial responded to in godly love, because that's a necessary ingredient, was producing a change in the way the Philippian brethren and sisters were living. That wasn't a false joy that he had. That was a genuine rejoicing, as he speaks of in verse 18. And we can bring genuine rejoicing to our brethren and sisters in the midst of bitter trials if they can see that their trial has had a genuine, life-altering impact on how we're living. And the reason we changed was out of love for our God, knowing that we have to lay down our life and change whatever is necessary to give to the need of this brother or sister in trial. Godly love can bring that kind of edification, so that when one member of the body suffers, the rest of the body doesn't sit back and say, well, I'll pray for you, and that's all I'll do. Prayers are important. Don't want to minimize those at all. But those of us who are close enough to the situation, we need to change our life and start giving to that need so that those kids won't be raised as orphans, spiritual orphans, or that home will have whatever the house needs, or that family will have whatever is needed on a continuous basis. That's godly love at work in the ecclesia. In Deuteronomy 15, just picking up on Brother Skip's comments last night about how each of our topics are rooted in the Old Testament. Sorry, we should first go to 1 John 3 for probably the final time. My mistake. Just to make sure we make the connection. We've seen it all week. You're probably already aware that John defined the laying down of our life in verse 17 by stating that if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need yet closes his heart, how can the love of God abide in him? John didn't create those words. He's quoting from Deuteronomy 15, because the law of Moses lays out, if we go back there, what godly love looks like. It means step one is to identify the need of a brother or sister, and step two is to give to that need by faith and without any strings attached. So the principle of laying down our life for those, for our brethren, by giving to their needs, exists back in Deuteronomy. As does the principle of loving God with all our heart and our soul and our strength. We won't take the time today, but take a look in Deuteronomy 30. The reason we know that it's there in the law, the need to love God with all our heart and soul and strength, is because the Israelites responded by saying, I can't do that. There's the evidence that they understood what godly love is all about. Their response was, I can't do that. Moses says, yes, we can. And this is how we'll do it. But in Deuteronomy 15, there are seven principles to giving that is laid out in this chapter. In Exodus 23, we won't turn it up, we know that every 7 years the land was to lie fallow, letting the poor and the wild beasts eat off it. Wasn't a good business decision, but that's what godly love looked like, and the poor and the stranger and the wild beasts were to be fed. In Deuteronomy 15, we know in the 7th year, all debts were to be forgiven in verses 1 and 2. So you can see how this would be an extremely poor year, this 7th year, from a personal standpoint, from a business standpoint. You're not going to raise any crops, and anyone you owe, that owed money to you are now forgiven of their debts. And it's within this context that Moses describes these 7 principles of giving. And we need to recognize up front the principle of giving is not about money. It could be, but not primarily. It's about giving our time. It's about giving our counsel. It's about helping with Bible study. It's about helping with someone's home repairs if that's what they need. It's about opening our house to accommodate someone to live there if they need a place to live. It's about becoming a genuine friend to someone's children if they're in need of friends in the ecclesia. That's what giving to the need is all about. These are the genuine needs that our brethren and sisters, that each of us have. And the other indication that it's not just about money is I haven't found, at least, any record of Jesus ever giving any money to anyone. And yet he gave and gave and gave to the needs of others. You see, it's not about money. It's about giving what people need. In verse 8, we read, in verse 7, if there is any poor among you, one of your brethren in any of your towns within your land, which Yahweh your God gives you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your brother. But in verse 8, we are to be generous. You shall open your hand to him and lend him sufficient for his need, in that he wanteth, or whatever it may be in the Revised Standard Version. So principle number one of giving is open your hand wide. Be generous. It's the opposite of a closed fist. Secondly, we are, as it says, to give based upon the person's need. Human love gives out of surplus. If I have some left over, I'll give it to you. Godly love gives based on the need, not out of surplus. The natural tendency is for us to take care of our own needs and then give from the leftovers. Godly love doesn't give from the leftovers. If giving from our surplus or from our excess is the basis for our giving, when I have a lot of surplus, I can be real generous. But in those times when I don't have much surplus, don't look to me for any help. That's not godly love. Godly love gives to the need regardless of what's in the barn. One of the subtle evil thoughts prevalent in society today, to first take care of ourselves and then help others afterwards. And it deludes us into thinking that our obligations to help others begin after we've met our own needs. In determining what we give to our brother in need, all we need do is apply the second commandment. Love him as you love yourself. Put yourself in your brother's situation. If I was in his situation, what would I need? Not what would I want. It doesn't say give to your brother whatever he wants. But it does. Because that's what the AV says. And whatever he wanteth. And then we have to look below the surface and realize that what the Authorized Version is saying is what might be considered the Old English. In that which he wanteth, if you go back to Psalms 34 and verse 10, the young lions lack and suffer hunger, but those who seek Yahweh shall not want any good thing. It doesn't mean what the person wants. It means what the person needs. In that he wanteth is more accurately translated today in that which he needs. In the RSV and the New King James Version, it says, whatever it may be. But we give based on what we have determined by putting ourselves in that brother or that sister's situation and asking ourselves, if I was in that situation and I was in need, what would I want others to give to me? And then we give to exactly what that is. So if we're having trouble knowing or determining what it is that we should give, Christ says, put yourself in their situation and give to what the brother lacks. And that's really what the Hebrew word means there. Give to what he lacks, what he fails to have. So we don't give based on what the person wants. We give based on what they need. And we don't give whatever they ask for, because oftentimes when people are in need, they don't know what they need. And again, we're not talking about money. These could be physical needs. These could be spiritual needs. All they know is they need something and they need help. And they come to us and they tell us they need help. And we know they need help. And they think they may need these things. In reality, they may need something completely different. But we give to whatever it is they need, recognizing that we may have to discern their request and give them something different than what they're asking for. He also says in verse 8 that we shouldn't qualify the need. We shouldn't try to rationalize away this need. Well, you know, Brother Ken, if you had been a little smarter in your financial dealings, or you had been a little more careful, remember a year ago I told you to be careful, and you weren't careful, so you're kind of ending up in the way which I told you you might. So if you'd listened to me a year ago, you wouldn't have the need you have now. So next time, listen to me and go find someone else to help you out. But we have to be careful. We don't rationalize away the need because of the person's foolishness. It doesn't mean we give them whatever it is they're wanting. It doesn't mean we just give regardless of their situation. But we don't rationalize. We don't scrutinize the need. We don't tell ourselves that, well, if I give to that brother, I could spend every Saturday for the rest of my life giving to that brother, and it's like a bottomless pit. If he has a need, we give to it. And that's how we spend our Saturday afternoons. And likely, if the need is that great, there are others in the ecclesia that can help spend their Saturday afternoons with that brother. But don't rationalize the need, he says. Once the need is established as being legitimate, godly love will cause us to give to it, regardless of the impact it may have on us. And this is where laying down our life for our brother in need becomes so powerful. We don't look to solve his problems. We look to give to his need, whatever it may be, even to the laying down of our life, says John. In verse 9, we are to beware of base thoughts. Take heed lest there be a base thought in your heart, and you say, the seventh year, the year of release, is near, and your eye be hostile or evil against your poor brother, and you give him nothing, and he cry to Yahweh against you, and it be sin in you. The base thought is, the seventh year is right around the corner. In this case, whatever I lend to him, he's probably not going to get back to me in time. Therefore, I'll wait till the seventh year plus one day, and then lend to him, and then he's got 6 years and 355 days to get it back to me. Beware, the Lord says, of base thoughts. And you see, if the flesh is not first crucified, that's where my eye is going to be. Seventh year is right around the corner. I think I'll wait. Beware, Moses writes, of base thoughts. Because if we fail to give to a brother in need, God says it is sin in us. So if we are aware of a brother or sister in need and we place our own personal needs ahead of theirs and fail to put our own interests as secondary or crucify the flesh and do nothing to help, we stand condemned. Verse 6, we are to give freely, not grudgingly or with a grieving heart. And the Hebrew there for grieving is to spoil or break in pieces. You shall give to him freely, and your heart shall not be grieved when you give to him. you know, I've decided I'm going to give to you, brother, but it really breaks my heart to have to do this. Paul or Moses writes, don't give if our heart is grieving. Give because we are giving out of our godly love for this brother or sister. In 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, there's the whole Jerusalem Poor Fund. And you can trace these same seven principles that we find in Deuteronomy 15. We won't take the time now, but they're all there. And Paul says there we need to give as a cheerful giver, not under compulsion or of necessity. Because when we give begrudgingly, when we give with a grieving or broken heart, we now create a second problem for the person in need. Not only do they have the original need, but now they have the problem that of our obvious reluctance to help with a loving heart. Verse 10, we are to give by faith. Give to him freely, and your heart shall not be grudging when you give to him, because for this Yahweh your God will bless you. You give by faith, and you trust, and I trust